This is the Happy Rant Sports Podcast, in which Ted Cluck and Barnabas Piper rant about old sports, new sports, sports books, sports movies, and anything else related to sports that they feel like. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined, as always, in studio by Barnabas Piper. And Pipe, always good to be with you on a Friday morning talking about sports. We have some intriguing topics, and we also have a little bit of a time limit that we're working with, so I want to get right into this stuff. But I have to tell you, and I know we're not going to talk much football today, so I don't want to dwell on this. But
we've been football heavy for a few weeks, so we're gonna expand our horizons a bit.
Expand our horizons, talk about some different things, some cultural overlap into sports with Colin Kaepernick and Nike, obviously. But I have to tell you, and this is more cultural and social than football related. 1 week into fantasy football, after having not played for a decade, I can tell you without qualification that I absolutely hate it. And I'm reminded anew of why I hate it. And it's because of a very important self-discovery moment that I have. And I think what healthy, normal people are able to do is look at all the disappointments in their lives and like triage the ones that are relatively insignificant and like not spend much time on those. I lack that ability. Like for me, all disappointment is kind of equal in scope. So like having a baton death march of a week one in fantasy football and seeing all, like Matthew Stafford, I think was legally dead for a few minutes in the third quarter of his game.
I think every single one of your running backs lost a limb. So
every single running back lost a limb. It was like the battle of Shiloh, you know, for my team this week. I've got guys without limbs. I've got Matthew Stafford, like legally dying against the New York Angels of Death on Monday night. And I was reminded anew of just how much it ruins watching every game for me. And we can expound on that later. I'm not going to say too much more about it.
See, that is so funny because it's the exact opposite for me. Like a Lions-Jets game, I mean, other than it's you know, week one of the regular season, so I'll just binge watch all football. There's not a lot of reason for me to care about that game. It's just not that exciting. Those are two. I mean, Sam Darnold is a high draft pick. Other than that, there's not a lot of reason to care, except fantasy. And so it's the thing that gets me interested. Whereas for you, it's like that vested interest goes to the point of it's now vested disappointment. It's now vested pain.
Yeah, dude, it is. It's vested pain. And it's because you're a healthy person. You know, it's because you're a normal, functional, healthy person.
Or I'm just on the opposite end of the scale of unhealthy and I care about nothing. I'm not sure which, you know, dude, just like, whatever.
Whereas, see, that's a defense mechanism that I would like to explore. Like, I think that would be tenable for me. I would like to get there. So maybe I can like swipe my insurance card and lay on a chaise lounge in your office, and we could do some therapy sometime.
Maybe between the two of us, we could be a balanced human being.
Yeah, that'd be good, man. That'd be good. Let's take a shot at it. Piper, I want to talk about something in sports that's new, and it's interesting. Like, given where we are as a culture and all the newness and all the technology, like the fact of the matter is you really don't get a lot of things in sports that are new.
Right.
I want to talk about a new thing that combines two things that I really love, which is 90s hip hop and 90s and early 2000s NBA basketball. And what I want to talk about is a league called the Big Three. And the Big Three is a real thing that was started by the rapper Ice Cube. And it involves like old school, old timey NBA names. And I'm just looking at some of these rosters, man, and I'm realizing like I've got to watch some Big Three games. So you suggested this as a topic. I want to know like how
credit where it's due. I think a listener threw it our way and was just open ended like, hey, what do you think about this league?
Yeah, what do you think about it, Pipe? Like, have you watched any games? Like, are they playing games yet? Like,
they're in their second season, and they have, you know, it's televised. You can catch these. I think they're on, like, ESPN or, you know, it's probably one of, like, ESPN 67 or whatever. But, you know, it's televised. They are, I think it's usually, like, weekend tournaments. So it'll be, like, a two- or three-day event in a city. But, I mean, like, Brooklyn, Houston, they're playing in NBA arenas. It's not like they're playing in, you know, the municipal, you know, smells like cow crap because there was just a rodeo arena. So let me, for listeners who are not familiar, let me read off some names. just to get you excited about this. If you're like me, these names get you real, real excited. So,
dude, I can't wait for this.
So there's a team. There's a team. First of all, there's a team called the Killer Threes, which is fantastic in itself. Chauncey Billups, Steven Jackson, Metal World Peace, Josh Powell, Alan Anderson. Quick note about Alan Anderson, two sports star at a small Catholic school in the Twin Cities. Played against him in high school. He was excellent. Better football player than basketball player in high school. Ryan Hollins, if that name means anything. Mike James, he of the 10-day contract across the NBA who just came in and chucked. And you know who they're coached by?
Who?
Charles Effin Oakley.
Oh, dude. Oak was one of my favorite 90s vintage NBA players.
There is so much crazy on that team.
Dude, there's so much crazy. There's so many great idiots on that team. And, like, I feel like there's some premium idiots just across the board in this league. I'm looking at the Tri-State team right here. You got Jermaine O'Neal, Amare Stoudemire, Bonzi Wells, one of my favorite, like, local idiots. He grew up in Muncie. He born and raised in Muncie, went to Ball State, just down the road from where I grew up. Bonzi's always been an NBA favorite of mine. Their coach is Dr. J, Julius Erving.
Yeah.
So legendary NBA name there. Some really fun players in this league, Piper.
Yeah, Big Baby Davis is in this league. And then there's a few guys like Ryan Gomes and Quentin Richardson, who if you had asked me
Quentin Richardson.
I probably would have been like, those guys are probably still like kicking around the NBA on 1 year veterans minimum contracts. Like, and so this is not a YMCA league with like pudgy dudes and tucked in t-shirts. All of these guys, like I've watched enough of these games to go, you know, they're not explosive athletes anymore the way they used to be. You know, Metal World Peace, Steven Jackson, these guys were fierce. But like they play good basketball. They can still shoot because that's like the last skill to go for an old guy. That and passing.
Yep.
They're all crafty and they're still good athletes. And the thing is, this is televised and they're competitors, which means they don't want to lose. Like they're not out here yucking it up. They're trying to win.
I'm looking at a team right now called the Ball Hogs. Have you looked at the Ball Hogs roster?
I don't think I've made it to the Ball Hogs yet.
This is fun, man. So, I was going to ask you, but I'm answering my own question at this point. I was going to ask you if there are any white dudes in the league. And the answer is yes. There's one Brian Scalabrine.
There's also Chris Birdman. What's his face?
Is the team
that I just listed. So Birdman's in the league.
Yep, that's
hard
right.
Hard to tell if he's white because he's entirely inked over. But, you know, he used
exactly.
to be white.
So Brian Scalabrine is in the league. And the team that Brian Scalabrine is on, called the Ball Hogs, is coached by none other than one Rick Barry. So
one of the most hated man in NBA history by his
peers.
Right.
One of the all time like NBA tools, you know, dating way back to like when our dads were watching NBA basketball when they were
nobody liked Rick Barry. The only reason people like Rick Barry is because he shot free throws underhanded and everybody's like, see, maybe Shaq should try that.
Exactly. So yeah, this league just has some great people in it, some really interesting people. So I hope they're pulling ratings. I hope this thing has legs. You've watched games, Piper. Like, what is the game watching experience like in the Big Three? And sub question: are they ever coming to like Nashville and Memphis, such that we could get credentialed for this? So I feel like this is in the wheelhouse of a media credential that the Happier in Sports podcast could get.
I could see them coming to Memphis because two things. In fact, they may have already played in Memphis. It's 90s. These is like 90s rough and tumble basketball players run by a hip hop guy. And Memphis is a convergence of a lot of that. Just like culturally dirty South, rough and tumble basketball.
Yep.
And like Memphis is a good basketball town. People there love their hoops. And so I could see it. I don't think it's going to come to Nashville. Nashville doesn't care about basketball. Nashville is a crappy sports town in general, except for the Predators. And hockey
is it's a weird sports town.
Which is it's a little bit like, you know, when people move to LA, they're like, nobody here really cares about the teams because there's a billion other things to do and the weather's perfect. Nashville's like that, except really sweaty.
Yeah, it's the sweaty version of that. Like, and I feel like Nashville attracts because of like kind of what Nashville's known for, it attracts people who don't care about sports.
Right. You know, which is why hockey took off, because it's a weird, like, it's not a mainstream sport. Like, it used to be one of the main four, but now there's not really a main four. Hockey's kind of a more, not like a hipster sport. It's just more of like a regional weirdo sport. So
I feel like hockey is just more of like a thing to do in Nashville. You know what I mean? It's less about like, you know, your average Nashville Predators fan isn't like breaking down the game and like they didn't grow up in like, you know, Medicine Hat, Ontario, like really caring about hockey.
Yeah, like, they're not like, oh, their defensive formations are just terrible. They're a little bit like Chicago Bears fans, where they're so rabid about their own team, and it's like blue and gold gear everywhere, and Smashville and all this stuff.
Dude, right. They've been like impeccably branded in a way that the Titans just have not. They're the marketing inverse of the Titans.
And the fans are rabid about them. And I'm not like, I think maybe 10% of the fans could name a player from half of the other rosters. You know,
I'm going to lay a theory on you.
Okay.
And this is a Nashville sports theory. And then I want to get back to the big three, because there's another interesting thing or two to say about it. My Nashville sports theory is as follows. If Nissan Stadium was a dome, I think the Titans would, I think people would care a lot more about the Titans. Because look, dude, the fact of the matter is, you know, 85% of the football season in Nashville, you know, you're looking at, you know, driving out to a stadium, overpaying massively for parking, and then sitting in like 90 degree heat, getting baked in the sun with like 90% humidity. And like, that's just, compared to a big HD TV in your living room where it's climate controlled and perfect, you know, that's just not attractive. Whereas, you know, for the Preds, you know, if you're a Nashville resident, you can go and drink an overpriced beer in like a honky tonk, or you can go and drink an overpriced beer in a different like climate controlled room and watch a hockey game. And I just think that's part of the magic of, you know, being a Predators fan.
But you know how we were talking about when we were a couple episodes ago, we were dogging on the Titans, which, well, I say a couple episodes ago, that's probably been every episode.
Going to do it every episode, and I want to.
it'll be our new Manziel minute, since Johnny Manziel seems to be on hiatus from actually playing football.
Exactly.
So it's the kill the Titans minute or something like that. But the thing that the Predators have done is, like you said, it is exactly the opposite of what the Titans have done. When you go to a Predators game, There's a buzz. There's excitement. Everybody's in gear. There's a rhythm to the game. You know, everybody knows what to do and what to say when there's a penalty on the other team, when a goal is scored, when there's a line change. Like, there are these. It's got a little bit of a European soccer flair too, where there's like these corporate chants that people do. And some of them are wonderfully like crass and verbally abusive to the opponents or the referees, both of which is fun. And and so you get in there, like, you don't have to care about hockey, and all of a sudden you're like, I love this experience. This is a thing that I want to do more of. Like, I can maybe name two guys on the Predators, but I'll take every chance I can to go to a Preds game. The Titans, I can name most of their roster, and I'm like, nah, you'd have to pay me. I'm not going to their games.
Dude, right. Yeah, because it's uncomfortable, it's not fun, it's loud, all the things that we talked about last week. But Piper, I want to point out one guy on the Big Three website. So I'd like you to go to a roster called the Three-Headed Monsters. I'll give you a second to do that. Go to the Three-Headed Monsters page. Three-Headed
Monsters. Great logo, kind of a lame name, but
yeah, exactly.
It's a three-headed dragon coming out of a basketball in the logo, and it's strong. All right, I'm here.
Dude, so the Three-Headed Monsters have Kwame Brown, one of the monumental, like, prep to pro busts of
all
time. One
of the monumental Michael Jordan ruined this guy's psyche.
Exactly. Stories. Michael Jordan broke this guy completely. You can still see it in Kwame Brown's expression in this picture.
Yeah. Like, you can look deep into his eyes. Empty and glassy.
Hollowed out. Like, his expression says, I've been hollowed out by Michael Jordan. Like, I have nothing left. But I want you to scroll up two guys from Kwame Brown and look at Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Which is an old NBA name that I loved.
Yes. And also an old NBA player I loved. I absolutely loved him in his prime.
Oh, most definitely. He was super fun. And I'm stoked that he's in this league for a couple of reasons. He has really embraced the gray in his beard. And I think if you look at Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf just right, he almost looks like a black Ronnie Martin in this picture. Except yeah, that unlike
he's got unlike, crow's feet, and Ronnie has, you know, his youthberry has fended those off.
His youthberry has fended those off. Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf looks like a guy who's comfortable with his age, unlike Ronnie Martin, who's massively uncomfortable with it and still sees himself as 24 years old, even though he's, you know, probably 50. I feel like Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is what Ronnie should strive for in terms of aging.
Do you think, you know, Ronnie needs to change his name? And, you know, so because in college, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf was Chris Jackson.
Yeah.
And Chris Jackson played at LSU. And yeah. he was like the best guard in the SEC since what's the dude's name? We just talked about him. A former LSU guard, white dude, floppy socks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Pistol. He was averaging high 20s in points. He was torching dudes. He was one of the best outside shooters. He could get a shot off against anybody. Converted to Islam, changed his name to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. He was the original national anthem protester. And it cost him his career in the NBA. Like he would have been a really good bench scorer or starting guard, depending on how the league went. He could torch guys, but he would protest during the anthem. I don't think he sat down. I think he just covered his face and looked down. He held his hands in front of his face as Muslims do when they pray. And he was hated by the masses. Now, it was kind of pre-internet, so it was less of a big deal. But that was a guy who probably could have played another 3-4 years as a bench scorer kind of guy. And he was kind of gone because he wasn't worth the trouble to NBA teams. Yeah.
Dude, that's fascinating. Yeah, that's so interesting. And I'd totally forgotten about that, like, social aspect of Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf's career. I just remember the basketball stuff. But really, really interesting. So, Pipe, let's use that as a segue into a huge story that really has, like, outcomes probably related to both of our employers in a weird way. You know, it's a story that has just a lot of impact across the culture, and that is Nike and Colin Kaepernick. So 2 weeks ago during week one of the college football season, Nike drops a new ad campaign, the centerpiece of which is Colin Kaepernick, very controversial socially. I don't know. I honestly don't know how much I can say about this, given who my employer is and given the fact that we are a Nike school.
Well, I'll give the details then, so you're off the hook. Yeah. I mean, not just the details. So Nike rolled out this ad campaign built around Kaepernick, and the slogan was "Just do it, even if it costs you everything." You know, there's some ads, and Kaepernick's walking around looking very chic with his sweet afro in a, you know, looks like Midtown Manhattan or something like that. You know,
cool looking guy. Yeah. I mean, all other things aside, one of the more cool looking athletes that we've had.
He could work in fashion, he could work in television. Right. He's a very pulled together, cool looking, articulate person who just, you know, he can do whatever he wants.
He could also still work in pro football, given who some of the quarterbacks are in the league right now. But you know, nevertheless. Yeah.
So that and therein lies the crux of the ad. Colin Kaepernick very publicly was one of the first and foremost players to begin protesting during the national anthem. And I say that because he's not protesting the national anthem, which is what a lot of our media is portraying it as. He's protesting police violence against minorities and using the national anthem as the means to do that. So he started sitting down on the bench. He was publicly chastised in a very respectful way by a former, I think, Navy SEAL, Special Forces guy, and said it would be more respectful if you knelt with your team during this time. So they can stand and put their hands over their heart. You can kneel. So this is a Navy SEAL or Special Forces guy who says this. Kaepernick listens. He does this. And other players joined him. And when his contract was up, he couldn't get re-signed. He had been a guy who took San Francisco to the Super Bowl and I think another NFC championship game. He had been he was up and down as a starter, but a talented football player, and he would be one of the 35 best quarterbacks in the league, which means either high-end backup or low-end starter in the NFL now, I think. And he can't get a job, even though everybody in the NFL world says – we can't find 30 good quarterbacks. So Nike builds this campaign around him, essentially saying, do what you must, even if it costs you everything. Do the thing you believe in. Invest in the thing you believe in, even if it costs you everything. So what's fascinating to me about this, I mean, there's the social aspect, but the monetizing of the social aspect is the thing that I can't quite get my head around. You know, we've got, you've got people who are like burning their Nike gear on the one hand. And then, but then there's also people who are like buying Nike gear because they think it's a cause. And I'm like, that's a multi-billion dollar industry. They do not need your dollars. They were doing just fine when they were using like a generic shooting guard to promote shoes. So it's a really interesting mix of like ethics, social stuff, using controversy to sell things. Like, is that dirty or is that genius or both? Mm-hmm. It's a real interesting story.
Fascinating. So yeah, this year I teach a PR writing class every fall, and you know, the Kaepernick thing hit right at the beginning of the class. So it's been on our minds and we've been talking about it a lot. And I'm curious as to what you think, Piper, of this just from a purely marketing standpoint. So, you know, Nike kind of throwing their hat in the social justice ring in a controversial way. Like, do you think at the end of the day, ultimately this benefits Nike? Do you think it's a debit to Nike? Or do you think it's, you know, the kind of thing that will blow over such that it really won't move the needle one way or another for that company? What's your thought on that as a marketer?
I think it's a paradigm for marketing that is really fascinating. So I don't think this particular campaign is, I mean, it's not like it's going to make or break Nike. The people who have burned their gear, guess what? They already paid for it. It's not like they burned down a Nike store. They burned stuff they already bought. So Nike has their money. And if they're going to stop buying Nike, that's okay. Somebody else is going to start buying Nike, or they're going to forget about it in 3 weeks when Nike rolls out, you know, the Air Jordan 44s or whatever. So I don't think this campaign is going to make a huge difference one way or the other. The paradigm of attaching yourself to a social cause or a social phenomenon for the sake of monetization is really unique and interesting, because that's not something big companies usually do. Like,
yeah,
you know, even Apple, who's a very socially conscious or portrays themselves that way, they don't really do that. They create their own narratives and stories and kind of sell those as ads. So I'm wondering, like, what precedent does this set? So is Adidas going to come out and have, you know, a lot of say? I mean, taking other social phenomenon things that are very meaningful stories, like a bunch of female gymnasts who have, you know, who have very publicly stood up to abusers. Like, is that a thing that that they will then put into a campaign of some kind? And if so, is that using them? Is that honoring them? Is that rewarding them for their bravery? I can't quite sort this out. Like, I can't decide if Colin Kaepernick is being used.
Yeah.
Or if he's like, man, this is something I believe in and I'm getting a paycheck for it. So why the heck not? Good for him. So that, you know, is Under Armour going to get into the politics game? You know, are they going to do something against the president or for the next candidate or something? Like, I think it creates an opportunity for an advertising and storytelling shift that's pretty uncomfortable, and I'm not quite sure I like it.
Dude, it really is uncomfortable and it's hard to talk about. And you know, just even the college that I teach at, you know, as is standard for sort of, expensive Christian private colleges, you know, a lot of our diversity comes via the athletic teams. And a couple of basketball players were hitting me up about it after the story broke. And, you know, they would be very disappointed if we, you know, if we parted ways with Nike. And I just think it's the kind of move for Nike that, like, further endears them to, you know, the biggest chunk of their market share is still sort of urban youth. And, you know, not that they ran the risk of losing that market, but I just think it further endears them. And
I guess the question is for the athletes you're describing, that makes total sense to me, because, you know, if they're so you have not said this, I'm putting this out there. If there was a dispute between, you know, donors to your school or alumni, you know, people who have some influence who are uncomfortable with this Nike campaign, And then the athletes who feel that this is, you know, this is a cause worthy of being part of, or a statement that they agree with. So they would like to stay at Nike school for, right, you know, basketball gear, football gear, whatever it is. I get where they are coming from, the athletes in
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
My question is, though, like, does Nike actually believe this? Or are they simply using the momentum of a story? Now, it's a risky thing. So it seems to me that they are yeah, taking a side, because there's an inherent risk in this. Of course, the president came out and was like, Nike's stock is tanking. It didn't tank, by the way. It dipped along with the entire stock market. And then like two days later, it was right where it was. So, you know, fact checking is important. But
I mean, not for us, but for the president.
Right. I mean, you know, if you're in a position of actual power and influence, you should probably fact check things. So that's the thing that I'm like, it just, when you combine money with cause or money with mission, your motivations get real jacked up real fast. So
I'm confused by it as well. And I totally agree. And I think even more broadly, Pipe, and this is maybe a bigger discussion, maybe for the actual Happy Rant, but I think all of this is wrapped up in the kind of persona work that day-to-day people do on a day-to-day basis. You know what I mean? So
what do you mean by not persona only, work?
What I mean is, not only are you invited to decide what to actually do with your Nike gear, but your decision about what to do with your Nike gear becomes a part of the persona work that you do via social media, because you don't just, throw your Nikes into the garbage in a vacuum anymore. What you're doing is endearing you to one audience and alienating another. Yes.
Everything is a statement. You know, we talked about on the regular episode, like, people are signing social justice statements. Well, you know, trashing your Nikes is signing a social justice statement. It just costs you a lot more.
Absolutely. And I see it in my classrooms, you know, and it's such an uncomfortable but yet fascinating thing to talk about in a classroom, because you're seeing that even the comment that a student makes after he raises his hand in a discussion in a classroom, it's still persona work, you know, and like, I know the girl in the class that he's trying to impress, and I know what her political views are. And, you know, it's a fascinating kind of shell game.
Do you ever grade on that scale? Be like, you know, it was an accurate comment, but that was like a C- in impressing her.
That was a C- in impressing her. I know the girl that you're trying to make a run at, and I know that what you're saying would not resonate with her.
She thinks you're a pompous douche, just not that into you. So
not the kind of pompous douche that she would like. Exactly. Exactly.
This is definitely I totally agree. It's definitely a broader culture thing than Nike and sports. I went and met a guy to talk about creating audiobooks. So just a publishing meeting at a local Nashville coffee house. But it's a cause coffee house. So their proceeds go towards sponsoring children in need and providing food. And so it'd be a really good cause. Yeah. And I rarely think about my coffee consumption as a cause. So,
dude, nor do you. I would make the argument any human being only has so much capacity for like cause related things. And certain people have more than others. I think you and I are probably low on our capacity on that spectrum. So we're alike in that. But like, if I literally thought in an earnest way about every cup of coffee that I drank, I would have time for nothing else. I would be exhausted. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, so, I feel like that's a decision you can make one time, or like if you're going to order coffee. So like I order coffee from Lagares Roasters because Hector is a friend of the podcast, starting a small business, great guy, doing good things with his business. I'm like, you know what?
Has great coffee.
Yeah. You know? Also that. There's a wonderfully self-serving purpose in this. But I made the decision once. I don't look for a cause every time I'm going to buy coffee or buy bread or, you know, buy hamburger meat. And but the problem is, if I have to do that every time I go and purchase anything, now I understand why people live in communes and make their clothes out of burlap sacks, because it's way simpler mentally than trying to choose who you're going to piss off by buying a brand.
Exactly. So now, like, what the sneakers that I wear to my classroom are now going to be evaluated through this prism of like, what does Cluck think about social justice? You know, I mean, it's stuff like that.
You pull out your iPhone and somebody's going to be like, you know, somebody got paid like 11 cents to make that, right? You just want to like smack them in the head with your phone and hope it's like a plus size so that it really hurts. And it, exactly. it just, these are things that So, I mean, from a marketing standpoint, Nike is both doing a genius thing because they, like, we are talking about Nike and neither of us give a rat's behind about Nike as a brand.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
just another brand of clothing.
Exactly. So
they're genius in that way. But I think they're muddying the waters. And I mean, I think the marketplace is just, it's going to get more and more confused the more people try to attach morality to commercial enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think if you compare, you know, right now with like, I don't know, 1998 or whatever, there are so many more things that we've attached morality to. Like coffee in 1998 was just coffee. Coffee today is a moral decision.
Which is ironic because morality as a whole is a lot fuzzier and less like we can't agree on what's right and what's wrong. And we don't have a Judeo-Christian ethic of anything anymore as a society.
Dude, that's right.
So it's morality of self-justification and what feels good. So the Nike thing is like it's a cause I'm attached to because I feel part of that cause, not because I can give a rational, philosophical or theological explanation of what is good and what is bad.
Dude, that's right. And it's because in 2018, literally everything you do is so public. If you're on social media, if you're in that world, like, you know, no decision that you make, no meal that you eat has to take place in a vacuum. You know, every single meal, every single cup of coffee, everything is, you know, is a part of your own image curation such that you're either using it to like, you know, add to or detract from your persona and your, you know, the way that you're trending. Whereas, you know, in 1998, a shoe purchase happens in a vacuum. You know, you went to the mall and you were like, I hope I do or don't run into so-and-so at the mall as you're buying your shoes that you either are or aren't proud of. But that was largely a private decision.
Well, and, yeah, I mean, and clothes were status symbols, but almost entirely based on cost. You know, if you wore Timberland boots and I bought my boots at Walmart, like you were infinitely cooler than I was.
Absolutely.
If I wore Nikes and you wore Reeboks, like there was a period where you were cooler than me, but most of the time I was cooler than you. And, you know, if you wore whatever it is. And so the status was all based on, you know, cost and popularity, which is a nebulous, useless thing.
Yeah.
But at least it wasn't a moral decision. I never looked at a person who wore a brand of clothes and was like, why do you hate children?
Yeah,
but that's
exactly.
That's kind of what it's turned into. It's like, oh, you don't like black people because you wear brand X. Oh,
yeah.
you're a social justice warrior because you wear brand Y. And that's exhausting to me, and it does make me just kind of want to be like, you know what? I'm just going to like cut holes in a garbage bag and wear that around.
Dude, seriously, this very thing that we've identified is the reason that I enjoyed being alive in 1998 so much more than I enjoy being alive now. Like,
also, there was no Twitter in 1998.
Dude, there was no Twitter. There were so many. Also, I was like, you know, the perfect age, and I had my whole life ahead of me in 1998, whereas now, like, it's not the same. You know, I'm Mahmoud Abdul Rauf and I are a lot closer in age than I am with current professional athletes today. But Piper, we have time for probably one more topic, and I want to talk about television. And, you know, you in our show notes, in our pre-production meeting, you pitched this as sideline reporter / in-game interviews.
Uh-huh.
I want to take it in a little different direction. I want to obviously let you talk about that for sure, but I want to talk about Monday Night Football, and again, not because of the football, but because of like the what used to be cultural impact of Monday Night Football versus the reality of this last Monday night was the very first Monday Night Football game. The in booth crew was Beth Mowins and Brian Griese, and as much as I'm a college professor and I would love to like champion Beth Mowins being in the booth and look like a real sweetie and do some persona work because of that. Like that would be very easy for me to do, except that listening to that crew do a Monday Night Football game, it was hard because not because they were really bad, but because they should be doing Tuesday Maction. I mean, it was a context thing where, you know, I'm old enough such that like Monday Night Football used to be special. And it used to be like the best crew, the best matchup, the best time slot. It was really exciting and interesting. And just hearing Beth Mowins and Brian Griese do the very first Monday Night Football game of the season was like mind blowing to me. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. Like I had the exact same thought of like it. We have reached the point due to our last topic where it's not really safe to criticize certain people doing certain jobs. So like saying
for
something
the record,
negative,
Beth Mowins is my favorite. She's the best. She's the best broadcaster there has ever been. That's my on record take on Beth Mowins.
Yeah, it's been brutally hard for women to get into the broadcasting booth, especially a nationally televised game in the America's most popular sports league. So that there's a genuine that's a real thing. However, she's not Monday Night Football announcer good.
And to be fair, neither are Joe Tessitore and Jason Witten.
No, although they're better than last year's crew of Sean McDonough and whoever was yammering alongside him. Like, McDonough put me to sleep. Yeah. He was just boring. Tessitore is at least a good, like...
Tessitore is a good broadcaster.
Middle-of-the-road play-by-play guy. Witten is just... He's a little dry. There's not a lot of... I mean, at the same time, you know, maybe by week 8 they'll be better. They haven't done this before together. So, it felt like a... That was a high energy announcing crew who they clearly loved football, and they didn't like botch the game. They didn't say dumb stuff, but it was just like Monday Night Football is supposed to be it's the football game with gravity. It's a game of it's the game of the week. Although I guess that's a little bit more Sunday night now, but it is a game of the week. And they felt like if I tuned into the Big Ten Network and I saw the University of Minnesota playing Nebraska, and they were announcing, I would not bat an eye. Yeah. And they would be that's kind of the right fit for the, and in fact I think Brian Griese was, you know, he was a college football announcer for like mid-level games for a long time.
Yeah, the mid-grade Big Ten game on the Big Ten Network. Yeah, you don't bat an eye at Beth Mowins and Brian.
So it has more to do with it has more to do with like gravitas. It's context. A little bit like going to a five-star restaurant and then being like the special of the day is the bacon cheeseburger. I love a bacon cheeseburger at Five Guys, you know, I'm here for the seared salmon, you know, like these are different things.
Yep. No, you're so right, man. And that's a great way to put it. Pipe, what did you have in mind when you pitched this sideline reporters in-game interviews topic? Because I want to hear your take on that with the short time we have left.
Well, speaking of wanting to hear takes, that was essentially what I wanted is just so – a listener pitched this. It was just sort of like a, what do you think about? And I was like, you know, I don't know what I think about. Yeah. But for years, football games have had sideline reporters. Historically, it has been sort of the it's like the attractive newscaster who gives updates on injuries. They've changed that up and actually put more skilled broadcasters who know the game better down there. And not just people who are there sort of for the aesthetic, let's say. The broadcasting version of a cheerleader. And they call them on-field analysts now instead of sideline reporters. Baseball has moved to this thing where they start doing in-game interviews in the dugout with managers and players, which it feels to me like it's just baseball throwing things at the wall to see what sticks, because they're like, man, people think our games are boring. Maybe if we have boring people say more boring words, they'll like the game more.
Exactly.
Especially if we can interrupt the action to do it. Genius.
Yeah.
So there's that's part of this. So I find that they add almost no value to the game ever.
Yeah.
With the exception of injury reports.
Yeah.
That's it.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right, Piper. And I want to take a kind of a two-tiered approach to this. One, the in-game baseball interview is fascinating. So I basically just started watching baseball this year. And it was a thing that I noticed them doing right away. And to me, it's baseball sort of throwing up its hands and acknowledging like, we have so much time to kill here. You know what I mean? It's like playing a game with your kids on a long car trip. It's like you're just trying to kill the time. You're trying to fill hours.
It's the baseball version of the alphabet game. That's what the in-game interview is. Yes.
It's the baseball version of, dang it. You know what? We've listened to all our CDs.
I spy with my little eye a manager who's going to use cliches.
Exactly. We've listened to all our CDs. We've still got an hour and a half left of this trip. And let's see what this guy has to say. And, I mean, it's so crazy to think that in the middle of a pro sports game where people are being paid like ungodly millions of dollars to decide the outcome, you can just snag this guy. Hey, buddy, you got a second? You know, let's just vamp. Let's chat. And only in baseball could that happen. But I wonder what would happen if it happened in other sports. Like, what if you grabbed Bill Belichick during a Patriots game and asked him some questions? Like, he would kill you. I mean, he would end your life.
I think baseball kind of got the idea because they always do it, you know, heading into halftime, you know, the halftime interview. And to be fair, those have created some of the most entertaining moments in sports broadcasting history.
They have.
But it's like one in a million. You know, most of the time it's like Brad Stevens going, you know, we just got to do what we do better. And, you know, being very genteel and kind. And then occasionally you get Greg Popovich, you know, just giving Doris Burke the business and you know, being like, Doris, that's the dumbest question I've ever heard. I'm never going to answer that. And, you know, that's, you know, amusing. Because they're both really good at what they do. And so it's a little bit more like sparring.
Yeah.
What I think they need to do is do like a live to tape thing on those where they record them and then they decide during the commercial break. That one was dumb. We're not going to air that. So then they have some other like canned highlight content or like, oh, let's recap the first half, which is nobody's paying attention at halftime anyway. So it doesn't matter. But yeah, that's what baseball did is they were just like, hey, let's try to do that. Except it's just the beauty of baseball is the spaces in the game. Like it is a methodical spaced game. It's not unlike golf in that way where there's just like
you love it though.
Yes, that's I mean if you hate that about baseball, like don't change the game. Watch a baseball go watch game. Something else.
Watch a different sport entirely. Yeah, exactly. And you have to embrace the slowness and the quiet and the blank spaces. And to be honest, like one of the things that I've enjoyed the most about being a baseball fan this year and kind of re-embracing the sport is that as our culture becomes increasingly loud and cluttered, watching baseball is a way to declutter. And I've enjoyed that, just that headspace, like just getting into the baseball headspace. And I mean, maybe what they should do to placate these fans is periodically cut away to just a football game.
Yeah.
And then come back from time to time
I feel like, I mean, what baseball doesn't understand is that they are trying to, they're like, we need to attract new fans by not being what we are. I mean, it's like when McDonald's was
by
like,
not
we
being
need,
a baseball game.
McDonald's is like, you know what we need to do? Sell salads and smoothies. Like, you know what? Yeah. You know what you do well? Cheap burgers and fries.
Burgers.
So find more people who want more of that stuff. Like it's not. It doesn't work to change the game. That's dumb. Yeah,
exactly. No, I couldn't agree more, Pipe. I'm in 100% agreement on that.
I know we have to go in a minute, and I'm just telling friends that I'm going to be late for the meeting. So this is more important than whatever I have coming up next.
There you go.
I need to know how you are surviving the end of a baseball season. So your first invested season as a baseball fan.
Yeah.
Selected the Seattle Mariners. They were in the playoff race. And now, like 2 months later, they are not. They're just not a very good team.
To be fair, they were more than in the playoff race. Like they were incredible. When I came on board with the Mariners, they were in like an epic hot streak. They were incredible. They were fun to watch. Like everybody's going crazy with the Mariners. There was all this positivity. And they have fallen apart. And, you know, I think this is not a sexy answer and it's not super interesting, but really, the way I'm dealing with that is just football starting. And I'm such a football person that, you know, the Mariners could arguably be, I mean, they could be as good as they were when I signed on. And I'd still be excited and I'd be interested. But, like, I would have mostly lost interest in them by this point anyway. So, I mean, I think, and this speaks to a larger conversation. And we should have it on another show where you're not going to be, like, epically late for your meeting. But, I really think, Pipe, that the best thing to come out of this baseball fandom for me was just the enjoyment of watching baseball for what baseball is. So not even necessarily watching baseball for, oh, the Mariners are winning, therefore I'm enjoying it. It's more I'm watching baseball and I'm enjoying it. And
I totally
that being
agree.
Said, it's,
like,
it's more fun when they're winning, but it's still fun.
As a Twins fan, I have limited experience with success, but success in baseball is stressful. Like being mediocre is way easier, you know, and Seattle is kind of perpetually mediocre as well. But between the months of like April, May, and then through July, it's just sort of the soundtrack of summer. It's
That's
a,
right.
And so being a fan, like if you're a deeply invested baseball fan who's like rising and falling in every game and this player's performance and that player's performance, like it gets really tiring.
Yeah.
You know, but to kind of drop in periodically, have a game on in the background at night, sit out on the deck and listen to a game, like whatever it is, that's I love that. And
dude, I love it too. I love it so much. And it's the perfect, I would argue it's the perfect sport for a college professor because your summers are more languid. They're still busy. You know, you're still doing stuff. But like I could get up in the morning and watch a game recap or two every morning, not feel guilty about it, kind of take my time getting going. And, you know, now that the semester's back in full swing, I have no time and I hate my life. But like,
and now football's better because it happens on the weekends, which is the only time you might have a spare few hours.
Dude, exactly. Football happens at night and it happens in the weekend. So, you know, I can have a shot at like enjoying some of that. But no, man, I mean, as much as I would love for the Mariners to have continued on their hot streak, I mean, they are what they are. They are a middling team. And, you know, I didn't want to pick one of these front runners. I didn't want to pick one of the like four teams that's always in the World Series. That would have been dumb and boring. So I'm still glad to ride with the Mariners, although I've had I have to throw some love to my friend Kevin Rinkins. Not many friends get named and shouted out on the program, but Kevin is a good friend. Kevin is a diehard Tampa Bay Rays fan. Kevin has been like cranking up the Rays propaganda machine for me to try to get me to sign on with Tampa. And I have to tell you, there's been some temptation, less because of what Tampa is and their ceiling, and more because of just they have a crappy old dome. And as we've discussed ad nauseum, I'm a fan of crappy old dome stadiums. So
remember, they're going the route of the Mariners, which was from a crappy old dome to a new stadium. I mean, the Rays are going to do that, or they're going to be in a different city. So,
dude, exactly. There's not going to be more.
You
more
can't
time
hang your hat on that. It's going away.
Dude, you're right. You're absolutely right. And if they were to like change cities, then, you know, Kevin would be shopping for a new team as well. So there's a lot of moving parts in this.
It's just best to stick with your team. Like once you have a team, you just, especially with baseball, because it's a super long season, it's ride or die. Like the peaks and valleys are not nearly the same unless you're a Red Sox or a Cubs fan prior to winning the World Series, because you're always the bridesmaid, never the bride. The rest of us are like, we're just bored at the wedding. So I hope the food is good at the reception.
Dude, yeah, and there's so much I like about being a Mariners fan. There are so many players on that team that I still really enjoy watching play baseball. And I think that's another ingredient in the your team stinks now, but like there's still pleasure in it. Like if you enjoy the players, if you like watching the players, if you like the GM, you know, there's a lot still to like there. So so yeah, man, I appreciate the Happy Rant community for helping me enjoy baseball this summer. And it's been a fun ride, man, and hopefully many more great years to come on that level. But Piper, we have done what we always do on this program. This has been fascinating. It's been a good discussion this morning, and we have most definitely wandered to and fro. So pour yourself some issue-free Lagares Roasters coffee. Their cause is
guilt-free
making
coffee.
Guilt-free, politics-free coffee from Lagares Roasters. You can enjoy that regardless of what side of the aisle you are on politically. It is just a great cup of coffee. And Piper, until next time, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Want to learn more about God and His will for your life one verse at a time? I'm Quenice Petway, co-host of the Your Daily Bible Verse podcast. I'm inviting you to tune in and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.